Radio.com. If you plan to call in and speak with one of our hosts, please turn down your radio and separate yourself from any background noise and wait for the area code to be called on before you speak. And don't forget, Revolution Radio FreedomSlips.com is listener supported. So stop by the homepage, FreedomSlips.com. Visit the site support area to help support the host you're listening to's airtime. Thank you. Revolution Radio FreedomSlips.com, where the truth never sleeps.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I'm in such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace... Stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Welcome one, welcome all, and it is that time for Roundtable Live here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. Be rolling on until 4 a.m. in the morning Eastern Time. New ideas, different hosts every night, different subjects every night. You never know what's going to happen right here at the Roundtable Live. King Arthur has nothing on us. We're going round and round.
Welcome to Noreen Halpin's Wild at Heart Roundtable Show. I am your host, Noreen Halpin, and I'm broadcasting to you live from Southern California, where it is 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And on the listing for revolution.radio, this show would be listed as 12 midnight on Studio A because the server is on the East Coast. And let me do a sound check. Hold on one second. All right, you guys. I think you could tell I still have the stupid cold. But I'm going to do a sound check anyway. Okay. Sorry for the typing. Anyway. I mean, as far as, like, the clarity of the audio for the station, my cold, yeah, you know, the last time I broadcast to you guys, I had a cold. Here, and this is why I'm letting you guys know ahead of time, yeah, I will still talk tonight for my show. Oh, thank you, Gear Jammer. I am going to talk, don't worry, but I'm not going to talk a lot. And I know I said that last week, and I still ended up talking a little bit, but I think tonight a little bit less, because I don't want to strain my voice, because first of all, I've had a cold this long in a long time. Like, this has been like a 9-day cold, almost 10 days here. I haven't had a cold this long in a while, which tells me that even though I have some physical immunity conditions, right, that my immunity towards colds is still pretty good, because this hasn't happened to me in a while. Well, let me see. I think a year or two ago I had the flu, so that was kind of gross. Let me see. But this time it's just strictly a cold. Okay, Kier Jammer, talking more, that depends on if my voice allows me to tonight, right? So I kind of have to play it minute by minute, okay? But, you know, whatever. Like right now, I'm relaxed, I'm talking, and it's fine. So I think I will try to talk as much as I can before I can't, you know. But I was reading something about September. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. September, there was like a cold or flu season that kicked in, which is normal, you know, the beginning of fall. But my friend caught hers in September. I didn't get this from her, but I'm just saying I didn't get as far as I know, I didn't get my cold till, what, this is like the beginning of November, right? Okay, whatever. It is getting better, thankfully, because we really don't like to think about the times when we have a bad cold, right? And a few days ago, I was really bad. I mean, just horrible. But today was a lot better. And I'm just thinking I might sound kind of funny. But anyway. All right. So I'll do my shout outs to my friends. Oh, thank you, Gear Jammer. Thank you, thank you. That's cool. I kicked ass. Thank you. Okay. So I want to say hello who happens to be listening. These are my somewhat regular listener friends. They may or may not be listening, but I will give them shout outs anyway. Bob, Mark, Josh, Paul, Rudy, Harolyn, and Darren Dean. So, you know, if you guys are listening, welcome. Hello. So, let me see here. Another thing about, well, it's not just my cold, but a lot of drama with people. This is not, when I say drama, fortunately, I'm referring to drama that's not directly in my life, like directly around me, but related to close friends. And I don't mean fighting. I'm talking drama going on. But see, I am relating it to the astrology. And I think Pat, he's also an astrologer. If you're listening, you would agree that this past week has been quite a doozy. We just had a new moon in Scorpio for one, which, you know, that's not an unusual thing. It happens every year. But concurrently, we also had Mars opposite Uranus, and I think Saturn square Mercury. You know, different aspects like that transiting in the skies. But honestly, you know, because Mars opposing Uranus was in the air just before this new moon in Scorpio. Because, see, that would make it that grand T-square in fixed signs, right? Scorpio, and then Mars in Scorpio, and then opposing Uranus in Taurus. And that was the background energy this last week, this whole building up to this new moon, which culminated, I think, last night or something like that. Anyway. So, or into the morning, depending on where you live. Because where I am here in California, I think we, just like a lot of places now, where the moon is already in Sagittarius. Thank God. And I only say this because of these other aspects, especially Mars opposing Uranus. Oh, hey, Wally, how are you? You know, Mars opposing Uranus. Okay, that's, you're talking about two malefic, meaning strong planets already opposing each other in fixed signs, plus a new moon in a fixed sign. Forming like a T-square right there. There's no Leo involved and no Aquarius involved. Yeah, so there's no grand square. It's just a T-square. But anyway, but when you're talking about heavy hitters like that Mars-Uranus, that's very like, you guys want to write in the chat for me if you had some really crazy stuff happening do this last week, or those around you, okay? For me, what kind of cold, I mean, not that whatever, not that I've never had a cold like this in the past, but I thought that was my body's reaction to these transits. Plus, okay, my best friend, she doesn't live around California, she's out of the state. She wants to move back here, but anyway, she went through hell this last week because she actually broke one of her rib bones and had a torn muscle in that area, and she's afraid of falling again because she has seizures. This is so much going on. And then she doesn't have proper living care. That's another problem on top of that. Being in a lot of pain, so her pain management's really hard. You can imagine. She's had other kinds of pain, you know, because of these seizures. She's fell on her tailbone. She's had a concussion. Now she's broke a rib. And then now she's got a torn muscle. Can you guys imagine that? And you can't even rely on your live-in help. That's done through a caregiving agency and not somebody close to you. Last 2 years, yeah. Well, amped up energy, in my opinion, has been steadily growing since about 2012. But obviously, COVID really hit the accelerator on this, right? So let's kind of say maybe in the last 5 years, the acceleration of intense energies astrologically affecting us has been ongoing. But this last week, honestly, with these aspects I just described, has been quite crazy. So my poor friend, you guys, actually her name is Selena. I've mentioned her before. You know, I don't like to talk about people's personal problems too much on air, but please send Selena prayers, because this poor girl, she's not a girl, but imagine in the past many months, she's had seizures where she fell out of bed, hit her head, had a concussion, you know, maybe broken tailbone, that's not sure yet, and then definitely recently broke a rib this week and tore a muscle in that area, and there's fear of puncturing her lung. And I think the difficulty in breathing she has to do with the torn muscle is my guess, right, because that area. And so, you know, please send Selena prayers, you guys, because I am so worried about this friend of mine. I don't think she's listening. I am so deathly worried about her. Because, again, without getting into too much, her caregiver, which was like a adopted relative, I don't know, like a goddaughter, that did not work out. That girl is a little bit crazy, okay? So can you imagine you're in this much pain, you depend on another person to caregive for you every day, and this did not work out. And it's very, you guys, I'm telling you, I am complaining about the state of our United States, okay? Maybe because we're used to living in a first world country, that seems like medically we're slowly being a third world citizen, right? Because my friend, you know, I asked her, so can you get a caregiver? I mean, that's an obvious question, right? But she says in Idaho, which is where she's at, a lot of the agencies, they just want to take a lot of the profit and they pay the caregivers very little. So there's not a lot of caregivers in that state. Here in California, which is her goal is to come back here. That's another long, complicated journey, but it's a little easier, I would say. Yeah, and you know, so just to wrap this up about her, please send Selena prayers, seriously, because I want her to get care right away. There's like nobody she could rely on. You know, you would expect the state of Idaho to be a little bit there for her, but their agencies are all wrapped up in money. You know, this is what we've come to in this country, right? You know, 20 years ago, excuse me, I don't think this would have happened to my friend. I'm talking the United States 20 years ago, right? Pre-COVID, pre-whatever. I think we could have gotten people adequate, maybe not the best because, you know, my friend isn't wealthy, all right? So maybe not the best caregiving, but we would have definitely gotten more for her with no major problem that she and others are facing right now. I work for an agency, even though right now I'm taking care of my mom. But the point is, you know, this seems to be a state problem because I'm not sure that this is true in California. It is true in Idaho. So each state has their own politics, their own financial issues, or whatever. I think this corruption is what's going on in her state, okay, in relation to this story. So I am very worried about her alone. You know, she can't do a lot on her own physically because of these injuries. This poor girl also has bad vision. She had everything just slam on her health-wise in the last few years. Bad vision, hearing, tinnitus, migraines. Think about all this. She's had pneumonia. And then now these broken ribs from seizures, right? Anyway, that's quite a lot of physical health karma for one person. So yeah, prayers to ease her pain, number one. And number two, she needs more help. So with that, that's what's going on with that. See, this is why, you guys, and please don't misunderstand me. When I say individually, I totally sympathize why people have to move to different parts of the United States at this time to be able to make ends meet, home maybe, which is getting harder, I think, almost everywhere. I mean, I'm guessing maybe people can still buy a home in Kansas or Nebraska. I don't know. Okay, I just know that Texas used to be cheaper, I heard, to buy a house. Yeah, exactly, Keir Jemmer, thank you. But, I mean, okay, so, you know, obviously, more populated states like California here, New York, and other places have higher tax rates and impossible for people to buy a starter house, okay? So that's a given as to why people would move out of these places and go to places like Nashville, the Carolinas, Florida, maybe Texas, but I hear Texas is getting expensive. Are we having a Skype issue, or is it's my voice, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, let me know if my Skype is still not good. Thank you. So what I'm saying is individuals. I don't judge anybody for doing what they feel they need to do for their life, their family's lives, or whatever. Completely understandable. But the reality is that these problems that people are trying to escape from in prospective states are going to follow you unless we get rid of the problems, right? Get rid of the problems. This problem doesn't stop in one state border and just sit there. It jumps. It's like a cancer, right? And I thought recently, what is that line? America the Beautiful, isn't that line from sea to shining sea, right? What does that mean? That means that the beauty and the standard of living and the rights of the people living from the East Coast to the West, from sea, East Coast, okay, that's the earlier part of our history, right? The East Coast, still populated, obviously, to shining, to the South, the Midwest, the Southwest, shining sea. Oh, thank you. Okay, good. shining sea, which is the West Coast. So that line in that song covers the whole area. Well, maybe it doesn't describe the North to the South, okay, but it does describe, in a sense, East to West, the coast, right? Because the East Coast and everything in between and until you get to the West Coast is all part of the United States. Well, what's happening now, parts of the East Coast are being wiped away. When I say that, I mean like New York, especially NYC, or maybe New York in general, I don't know, being taken off the map. I don't mean literally. I mean taken off the map in terms of viability, right? So that's one shining sea coast. To the other, here, you have California, with its obvious problems, and even up to Oregon and Washington. That's the whole West Coast right there. There's problems in Washington and Oregon too, right? Similarities kind of to California. Shining sea, this way. So, from sea to shining sea, us as Americans should have our rights to have decent living, decent rights wherever you live. But if people are being chased out of New York, being chased out of California and the West Coast in general, then there is, think about it, that line in that song can't apply anymore. There is no sea to shining sea, right? People have to remember that. Make that stick in your head. No sea to shining sea anymore if we are wiping out parts of the coast. When I say wipe out, you know what I mean. I'm not saying we are doing it. They, the elite agenda, are trying to destroy America. And their first hit, I can't say their first. Chicago's in the middle of the country and it's being hit, so whatever, it's part of that. But their first hits are on the coast and, you know, of each side. But that's big areas of the United States. And to say that those are no longer parts of the sea to shining sea metaphor is bizarre. You guys, that is so weird. You know, it is so weird. They call it from part of the sea to a lot of the center of the country, America the Beautiful. No, they can't change the. No offense to Hispanics, and I'm not talking about Hispanic Americans, But here, right here in Southern California, especially in Los Angeles, right? Los Angeles is a Hispanic city, okay, on many levels. I would say even partially culturally now, somewhat, because of the amount of, honestly, illegal aliens, not even native-born, generational Hispanics, okay? So to me, I mean, you know me, I love California, and I live on the OC side of things where it's still kind of America, really, hanging in there. So, I don't know. Who knows tomorrow, right? But LA is already, in my opinion, gone. It's not run right. The mayor, Karen Bass, is a complete socialist, and residents are illegals. So to me, LA, which is not all of California, is not all of the West Coast of the United States, but sort of symbolizes it because San Francisco is really bad too. Okay, so these are cities that are almost like wiped off the American map, wiped off the American psyche. So the sea, the shining sea, sort of doesn't apply to those areas. To me, that's wrong. This is why I need people to get in their head, no matter where you move to, if you're an American, doesn't matter what part of the U.S., or even if you move to Mexico, or wherever, or Thailand even, okay? Or Burma, Philippines, understand, you can't ever really run away. I mean, I'm not judging people personally again, but symbolically, metaphorically, you cannot. And otherwise, the words in that song would mean nothing, because there would be no sea to shining sea if bits and parts of the United States are gone. Politically, statistically, numerically, population-wise, culturally, financially, and you know what they're trying to do, obviously. With the 50-minute cities, that's everywhere. That's even outside of this country, okay? So, you know, we have to remind ourselves, this fight for the United States, you guys, is not just about the United States, okay? It symbolizes a worldwide fight for rights. So they are right about that when people have said that when I was younger. I was like, really, how's that? But now I mean, I've been getting it for a while, but I really get it, you know? So, speaking of California, there's already been two very strange fires here. You guys probably heard about them. The freeway here, the I-10, yes, I've driven it many times, but the part that's in LA, which is like Culver City part, that part, there was an explosive fire. It is arson, because if you've seen the video depicting it, you'll see all the homeless encampments underneath, which obviously that was going to lead to some kind of hazard, whether it's unintentional or, in this case, they say intentional. Okay, and then after that, I'm going to play some audio about the, now this to me is a mystery. This seems like arson to me, because it already happened again after they put it out, and that's the historic air hangar in Tustin, and that's by that means I'm unfamiliar with. And that's more of a mysterious fire, but this was done by arson.
One of the nation's busiest highways is shut down indefinitely after a fast-burning weekend fire under I-10 in California. Officials believe arson is to blame. Miguel Almaguer has late details.
The badly burned stretch of Interstate 10 spans only 450 feet, but its impact has severed one of the nation's busiest roadways, snarling traffic, slowing commerce, and creating logistical nightmares well beyond downtown Los Angeles.
This is like a lifeline.
With its structural integrity at risk, the overpass was a thriving artery that shuttles some 300,000 vehicles every day, carrying nearly twice the number of cars as the collapsed section of I-95 did near Philadelphia. The 10-lane bridge in Los Angeles is now shut down indefinitely.
Our investigators have been able to confidently determine that the fire was caused by arson.
Saturday's explosive fire, believed to be purposely set, engulfed a pallet yard under I-10, even torching a fire truck. Guardrails melted, chunks of concrete fell to the ground, and exposed layers of rebar. Just last year, the governor was next to this very section of the Santa Monica Freeway, working to clear large homeless encampments.
The area where the fire started is leased to a private company. That company is now under investigation for how it managed the property.
With no timeline on when repairs will be made, tonight a city notorious for traffic has now lost one of its busiest roadways. Miguel Almaguer, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Okay, you guys. Yeah, it was done by arson. Which this little news bit, but that's what they have. And let me play the one about the one here at the air hangar, which is really strange, too. That's Orange County. This one is. But they're all Southern California incidents here.
Breaking news out of Orange County, a massive fire at one of the historic Tustin Air Base hangars. Eyewitness News reporter Eric Resendiz is live in Tustin with the latest details this morning. Eric.
John, Leslie, Rachel, as you can see right behind me, this historic hangar is still on fire throughout the morning. We've been hearing rumbling from the debris just falling. Fire crews out here still putting out the blaze, which seems to be under control and as being monitored. But we can see that about one-third of this wooden structure completely gone. Now, take a look. The fire was reported around 1 this morning. It is the north hangar that went up in flames that's located near Valencia Avenue and Armstrong Road. Air and ground crews battling this large blaze that took over the nearly wooden hangar that is 17 stories high. It is one of the largest wooden hangars ever built. Now, this is one of two hangars at the Tustin Air Base built in 1932. The historic landmark has made appearances in movies like Purple, Austin Powers, and Star Trek. Now, the fire battle did wake up residents in the area, and some left their homes to see the blaze.
I woke up and heard all these helicopters flying over, and I looked out and saw the smoke and the flames. These things have been here since as long as I've been around, and it's hard to believe that this one's probably going away. So to lose these, we'll never see anything like this again.
And just take a look. We can see those wooden beams and just embers surrounding that rim of that chunk that's completely gone from this historic hangar. The Orange County Fire Authority say that no neighborhoods needed to be evacuated. The cause of the fire, of course, is still under investigation. We are waiting to get more information from the Orange County Fire Authority regarding the fire over this historic.
Hello, I'm Mark Brown. Get more great.
See, that's really strange, you guys. I believe this was an intentional arson. I could be wrong because maybe they didn't think they could utilize this building anymore, so they just want to get rid of it. That's my theory. I don't know. There's a hangar here in the Long Beach Airport that, since they didn't use it, they turned it into a food court. So it's a kind of a hangout now, and that's cool. So they utilize history with that, which is good, but they couldn't do it for this place. Okay, I don't know. Maybe. Speaking of California, another story about our illustrious President Joseph Biden and President of China Xi Jinping. I guess they're meeting up in, or I don't know if they already did or they will be meeting up in, to get ready for this momentous occasion. They really cleaned up the homeless. And fentanyl and needle debris and criminal actions and cleared all that out just so that Biden can show off to the president of China how wonderful San Francisco is. Which, so the big question here is, they could do it for these jerks. They can't do it for the sake of the city and its residents and tourists. This just makes you mad, huh? Doesn't it? So anyway, Sticks Hexenhammer, he called it San Francisco, the Joe Temkin Village. That's a really appropriate name. Here we go.
All right, everyone. Centuries ago, when Catherine was deciding to tour her empire, a man named Potemkin got a bright idea. We're not sure exactly how canonical this particular story is. I'll give my thoughts in a moment. The idea was, well, everyone's living in poverty. The countryside is decimated. But I've got an idea. We'll make a fake village. She'll ride through. It's bright colors and, you know, the windows aren't shattered or anything like that. Nobody's living in squalor. And then we'll take the village down and we'll rebuild it along the route several times. So she'll see these, like, little, you know, miniature towns. It's literally nothing more than a facade along the main road, but she's going to think that, you know, things are going fairly well. We don't want to alarm her. It's called the Potemkin Village. And in reality, they probably just went through ahead of her and slapped a coat of paint on things, so to speak, and built a few facade structures to make it look better than it was, and it's just literally a propped-up front end or something like that. It's much more likely than the official canonical story. There's some historical disagreement.
You guys, I have to read this comment under this video. It's hilarious. All hail the Emperor Xi Jinping, the rightful heir of the Chinese Communist Empire, he who must have all roads cleaned of peasants and repaved in gold in order to grace us with his presence. Yeah, that's what's going on here. Totally.
Well, we have a great example now of a Jotemkin village, and I'm coining that phrase, and you should use it profusely. Xi Jinping, visiting California, well, Comifornia, he's there to see his good friend Gavin Newsom and, you know, tour around and, you know, see all the Chinese goods at Walmart, I suppose. And they didn't want his motorcade having to go through endless queues of homeless people, because that's a bad idea. Now, number one, optically, it's a bad idea because it makes the U.S. look decrepit. If you had chosen a normal, like, functional city, this wouldn't have been a problem. Like if Jinping had said, oh, I've always wanted to see Texas, I'm going to stop over San Antonio. Okay, you'll see a few drug addicts probably, but it's nothing on the same order of magnitude as San Francisco. It'd be sort of like if you visit Chicago or New York City right now, or, you know, fucking Detroit. If your entire opinion of the United States was formulated by a brief tour of Detroit, you'd probably think that the United States was a third world country. So optically, it would be a fail. No.
Now, in the comments, somebody said, we are a third world country. Well, look, realistically, we're not there yet. But definitely, parts of large cities are, right? For various reasons. So it's complicated, but yeah, it's all by design, which is really infuriating, right?
Number two, they didn't want to, I think, disrespect Xi by having him so close to the poor, so close to the destitute. So you know what they did? They shooed him all along, cleaned up the streets because they were filled with human feces and fentanyl needles and shit like that. Xi Jinping wouldn't have to see it. And apparently really beefed up law enforcement around the general venue as well. Like, going to treat any misbehavior as a federal case or some crazy shit like that. I think I saw that the other day. It's a Jotemkin village. The fact is that San Francisco, its problems are not entirely due to city function. They've been compounded by the national economy. They've been compounded by national policy as well. This is increasingly the case elsewhere. Why do you think Mayor Eric Adams of New York City just got raided by the FBI, for example, under the most shenanigan-y of goddamn possible circumstances? It's because of the border crisis, which he spoke out against. The border crisis is crippling New York City's economy. It's driving the crime rate up. There's mass homelessness. You can't compensate for everyone. They shuttle people out, you know, and they can only do it so quickly. People come in fast and be shuttled to the outlying areas. Same as San Francisco suffers from a combination of massive drug usage. It's had that problem for a while, you may know. The migrant crisis, a poor economy, enormous fucking cost of living in San Francisco. Have you checked out the rent anywhere near San Francisco that isn't an outright ghetto on the other side of the bay? have you seen the rent prices? I mean, I make six figures. I wouldn't want to move to San Francisco. I'd be living in a 10-2 problem.
Well, TikTok Hammer, he makes a pretty good living being a YouTube video content creator. Six figures, yeah, that's what I would guess with all the people. You know, he's got 502,000 subscribers. This video alone has, you know, 34,399 viewers. So, yeah, and then there's people that donate out of that group of people to him. So, you know, of it is that there is now, I know, a former host on this station, Douglas Dietrich, still lives in San Francisco. Nowhere is he even rich at all. But, you know, he lives in an area that is rent controlled and has that hasn't. See, the interesting thing, that has been left alone. That's amazing. I think if it wasn't for rent control, him and other people couldn't even live there. And I think that's how the people that work there is like in the service industries, like Sticks just mentioned, they might be actually renting out of a rent control domicile, right? So if you have three waiters from various restaurants and they all live in a rent control building, house, apartment, whatever, maybe they can make it that way, honestly. But if it wasn't for the rent control, which is not every residence in San Francisco. So, you know, yeah, it's obviously a city that's being manipulated to its demise. And anybody who thinks that the traditional people voted it, because let's face it, okay, you guys, besides the presidential election, local politics are important. So, yeah, people who still vote in these kind of weird, whatever, Democrat something, you know, officials into, say, San Francisco or Chicago, they get what – I don't want to say they get what they deserve because we suffer because these cities suffer. But how can anybody even think there's no correlation to these, you know, politicians and what has been going on?
Probably. I don't even know how people fucking make it. Like, if you've got, like, a so-called normal job – I don't understand how you can even exist in San Francisco. Where the fuck does the service industry live? I guess five people to a two-bedroom apartment would work for people that are in the upper middle class. That's about as close to making it as you can get in San Francisco unless you're hired by Google and you're like, well, my cubicle at work is bigger than some of the other. I think I'll just sleep here tonight. Boss, am I allowed to bring my mattress? So there was a bunch of homeless people. And again, drugs and human feces and weird shit like that. They cleaned it all out. People are beginning to notice that they're capable of doing that and simply unwilling to do so. If Xi Jinping is visiting, you know, the big commie head honcho, gotta make things look spotless. We don't want Xi to see that. But if everyday tax-paying Americans have to see it living in the goddamn city, that's perfectly fine. You know, no. We're not going to shoo the homeless along or do anything about the drug addicts that are sitting here outside of the elementary school because that would be unkind. But if Jinping comes or if the Super Bowl's here or something like that, some major event that makes a lot of money basically or involves political power, fuck the homeless basically. Fuck those drugs.
All right, you guys. It says here. I just searched for this. San Francisco is still in rent-controlled homes. More than 60% of renters live in housing that is subject to the city's rent control ordinance. Since a report also estimates that 65% of the city residents rent, that means that 39% of the entire San Francisco population lives in rent-controlled housing. Yeah, I was going to say, if it wasn't for that, nobody could live there if it wasn't for that. Seriously, it's almost like that. Right? Almost like that.
Drug addicts. Yeah, you're all being involuntarily put into treatment for the weekend because big kahuna Xi is here and Gavin really wants to suck his scrotum off. Probably did. He's probably into weird shit like that. He knows who's bitch he is. San Francisco is a Joe Temkin village. They've created a facade for Xi Jinping of all people that San Francisco is like an actual functional city. I've seen and heard from so many people who have either been, in some cases, fucking live there, and it ain't pretty. Somebody had an app that they created some time ago, still functional, for reporting human feces incidents, and all of San Francisco was a smear of brown. It's not surprising to me, of course. In the average city, if it's functional, it's mainly dog shit's the problem. Normally, you don't have a problem with human shit. That's associated with the fucking third world. But when you have 50, 60,000 people on the streets that don't have access to adequate plumbing, you know, where are they supposed to build a latrine? They're going to have to take over a park like Antifa. They'll have their Chaz garden next to the latrines. They'll just dig them into the soil, something like that. And San Francisco could disappear at any time anyway because of all the seismic activity there. And many people in the rest of California probably wouldn't even give a damn. Sorry, San Francisco clankers, but I'm just stating the obvious. I realize that some of you are based, but it's San Francisco. the proportion is really lopsided, I think, in a place like that. It would be in Detroit or Chicago. So I call it a Joe Temkin village because of economic policies of U.S. and California and the city of San Francisco, all compounded with other various national problems that are going on, all of which ultimately the buck stops here mode, they're Joe Biden's fault. San Francisco is a waste dump, effectively, and literally in some of the streets that are more popular for, you know, latrine usage. Can you imagine you're living in some old late 19th century apartment or something, all brick and, you know, looks pretty cool, but, and you're paying like $12,000 a month for rent, and you were in a nice neighborhood, but now basically your street was chosen for the one where people took like broken old toilets and just lined the sidewalk with them, and people come and fucking take a dump, and you're just hoping that they put the plastic bag in beforehand. Can you imagine living under such conditions? And the fact that in a country that has as wealth as the United States, that anyone who's not completely lazy and it's a self-interested way, they should be in those conditions. We could easily, for a fraction of what we're talking about spending on foreign aid alone, we could take care of the homeless crisis and the drug abuse crisis at the same time. Hell, I support ending the drug war. I have no problem with people using drugs. But if they're in need, it's a lot cheaper to treat them than it is to put them in prison for extended periods because they had too many grams of marijuana or something like that. Not that that's the problem drug. I'm sure the Haight-Ashbury is still more or less clean. Anywhere that the tourists go, the police will actually enforce the law there. Under normal circumstances, that doesn't include, I guess, the Xi Jinping visitation zone, but they had to clean it out. Can you imagine how much effort it took and how much hazardous duty pay and shit that they had to pay out in order to remove all the human crap from the sidewalks and the alleyways and around that area and along the stretch where Jinping's going? Xi Jinping, get a clue. Next time you come back, live stream out your window and go off course. Say, no, for security, insists that we take a different route right through the area where you happen to herd all the homeless people. Apparently, people in outlying areas are now suffering, and like the homeless and drug addicts and stuff are crowding their streets instead, and people are bitching and complaining. It's an illusion. It's the illusion of prosperity. And the illusion of prosperity in a city within an illusory state, within an illusory country, where Bidenomics is still, for some bizarre reason, being sloganeered. I don't know, that's the greatest idea, considering this sort of thing is happening. That's about all. Peace out.
Yeah. I like that video because it did cover a lot of area of what's really going on out there. Anyway, so I don't want to stray voice too much. I found another video here. This is interesting, too, because it does relate to California, okay? And it's from that series, California Insider. It's an excellent series, okay? And again, you guys, you don't have to live in California to know these problems, because, like I said, if you don't stop the problems, it's going to happen everywhere in the U.S. anyway. Can't escape them. This is why, yeah, watch all these things if you can or want to. Okay, this one is called Why California Suburbs Could Disappear in a Couple of Decades. Now, I'm going to send this to one of the regulars from the station, Dar, friend of ours that lives in the city of Huntington Beach, which is the center of this video, because the attorney general, I think, city attorney of Huntington Beach, Michael Gates, he's been interviewed by California Insider he's trying to fight, this is going for all, because Gavin Newsom has been picking on Huntington Beach in particular. So a lot of my friends went to protest against the mandates in Huntington Beach when COVID first started. So what they're trying to do, too, is build a lot of low-income housing, which you know what that does to a neighborhood. And Huntington Beach is a very, very nice, still nice. There's so many nice beach cities in Southern California and throughout California. Okay, but this is one of them. And I've been to this one many times. I go to it. It's close to me. So it is part of our landscape. And it's being, elites are trying to destroy it. They want California and maybe even New York for themselves. Screw them. They're not going to get it. Okay? That's how I feel. So this is an interesting video. Let's start it.
A quiet suburban beach town community. A lot of homeowners partnership. We're quiet. We love our beach. We have 8 miles of pristine, beautiful coastline.
A lot of different cities are actually mandated to develop where they don't really have, and they don't want the development, right?
The state's basically coming in with these housing mandates and saying, hey, local city councils, you can't exercise the discretion that the voters vested.
That is total communism, you guys. So un-American, right?
Did you with? You have to make the decisions we tell you to make. The unfortunate thing is, if this were to succeed, you would be looking then at high-density development and high-density living in only the 5% of the territory where 95% of California's population lives, leaving the other 95% of the territory untouched.
My guest today is Michael Gates. He's the city attorney of Huntington Beach. Today he'll discuss how the current housing mandates can change California's beach towns and what he's doing to protect his city. I'm Siamak Karami. Welcome to California Insider. Michael, good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You know, Michael, I've been going around as recently I've seen these apartment buildings that are rising up. You see these four-story buildings, and they have like a few hundred units. And before, I would never see these in California, especially in Southern California. And there's a movement in the state that they're developing a lot of these. And usually they have these amenities whenever you want to go see them.
And you guys, as we've discussed on this show and other shows before, these housing or apartment units this man is talking about is another slang term for them, stack and pack, whatever. That is the basis, you guys, for the 15-minute city plans, as you know. That's part of it, too.
They have really nice amenities, really nice swimming pools, and they cost significantly high, and they're very small when you go into the units. It looked like there is a shift in the landscape of California. You know, we're kind of going, when I came here, I saw a lot of single family homes, and then now we're seeing all these buildings going on. You're in the middle of a big lawsuit with the state, and we want to talk to you about this. Can you tell us why we're seeing these buildings and what's the plan for California?
Yeah, it's a really good question. First of all, the state in 2017, 2018 really began a much more aggressive housing policy and passed a whole bunch of new housing laws, basically mandating that cities do a lot more to zone for high density development and actually develop high density development. Interestingly, Huntington Beach, which is the 24th largest city in the state of California out of 482 cities, really has been given quite a burden, frankly, by the housing laws and by the state to develop 13,368 units of high density and at an inclusionary rate of 20%, which is what the state basically requires. We're looking at needing to increase our housing stock by as much as 50%. That's what estimates are, 50%. We have 81,000 dwellings in Huntington Beach. And so these aggressive housing laws, this aggressive housing policy by the state of California is having a massive impact on Huntington Beach. And the numbers that I just gave you, with the expectation of an additional 50, up to possibly 50% increase in housing stock, that does not include the numbers that may come down the pike in the next planning cycle, which is just a few years away.
If you haven't checked out CaliforniaInsider.com, we highly recommend you do that now, because we're going to have a lot of news and videos there. And on top of what we have there right now, we're building a really big platform to cover what's happening in California, so you can be informed. We're going to have more shows, more videos from all aspects of life in California. Go to CaliforniaInsider.com, and we'll see you there. You mentioned high density, and this is not just Huntington Beach issue. Like, it's happening across the state in a lot of the cities, right? Mm-hmm. For those that don't know much about this, what do you think the state would look like after a decade if these plans go through?
After a couple decades, we could easily, all the cities that are already developed could easily look like Santa Monica, right?
High rises.
Or like San Francisco, even worse, right?
So a lot of high rises.
A lot of high density. And when we talk about what is high density, you're looking at those pack and stack, like very vertical.
Four big ones, the four-story.
Yep, four-story or more with tons of apartment units in there and high density. We're talking about 30 units or more per acre. So it's a lot of living, a lot of people in small spaces, really just everywhere up and down the landscape. The unfortunate thing is if this were to succeed, you would be looking then at high-density development and high-density living in only the 5% of the territory where 95% of California's population lives, leaving the other 95% of the territory untouched. And I get it. Like, some of the 95% undeveloped territory in California is mountain ranges, a lot of it's agriculture, and we don't want to develop that. But there's still large amounts, large swaths of land of undeveloped, developable land throughout the state of California. That should be the focus.
And with the high-density living, is there more renters? Is it transient? Can you explain what you're talking about?
Yeah, with the high-density living, what you have is it's largely apartments, right? It's possible to get some condos, some home ownership or unit ownership out of it, but it's largely apartments. And so you have a lot more transient living. You have people moving in.
People come and go.
They move in for a year. They enjoy the city, but maybe they decide they have to move because of work to Texas or whatever, right? So then they're just moving. They're living there temporarily. And what happens is it really changes the culture of a community because you don't have people coming in who are as invested in the city, right? They're there to enjoy the place while they're there, but then they know they're going to move on or maybe they have to move on. Whereas Huntington Beach right now and other cities like Huntington Beach, where you have a high percentage of home ownership, is you have people who are invested in the community. They care about the community. Their department look like. They're thinking about what does my fire department look like. They're thinking about how important it is, for instance, like in Huntington Beach, to protect our wetlands, the pristine wetlands that we have in Huntington Beach, how important it is to protect it for their children, right? So their children can enjoy it and benefit from it. That's what you get from home ownership and longevity. But when you have much more transient living, people coming and going, you know, people naturally just don't have time to even think about stuff like that, right? And they're not thinking about, they may not be thinking about, I want my children to live here, right? If they're living in an apartment, right? So it's just a different way of life, and it affects and changes the culture. And I think, frankly, it affects and changes the investment that residents make in the city, in the community.
This episode is sponsored by Midas Gold Group. Do you feel the bills are getting higher and higher every time? Protect your wealth.
I'm trying to add a few more minutes till the top of the hour break.
And so in the next planning cycle, in each planning cycle is 8 years, the next planning cycle, we would get a brand new number. So in addition to the 13,368 units of high density, now we're looking at what we're hearing is possibly getting another possibly 30,000 units in the next cycle. And so that's a heavy load. And just to give you some context and perspective, 95% of the state's population lives in 5% of the state's territory. There are tons and tons of acres of undeveloped land out there, right? Huntington Beach, as I said, is the 24th largest city in the state of California. It's already fully developed. We don't have any place that's undeveloped to build new housing. What the state is basically asking Huntington Beach to do with these mandates, which we're challenging in court, is to redevelop Huntington Beach. It's redevelopment for Huntington Beach. So when the state says, we want to build housing, it's not that simple for Huntington Beach. For Huntington Beach, it's identify properties that are already developed and redevelop them. So it's a massive, in essence, tax on Huntington Beach, tax on the infrastructure, tax on our way of life. If the state was really interested in proliferating housing development, really interested in an aggressive housing program, increasing housing for the state of California, really what it would do is target the undeveloped areas of the state, including swaths of land in San Bernardino, for instance, swaths of land in Riverside, for instance. And work with those cities and work with developers to actually increase housing in those undeveloped areas. And we know just from our experience in working with other cities, there are cities like San Bernardino that are interested in housing because they want to increase their population, they want to increase their development, unlike Huntington Beach, which is, again, like I said, fully developed. So the state's program is completely misguided, and that's part of our challenge to the state, right? Our legal challenge to the state.
And what's happened?
Not misguided, done on purpose.
The thing is, it looks like some cities have to develop a lot where they don't really have the room. Like, it's, you guys are not alone, right? There's a lot of other cities, and I know a lot of mayors and a lot of people that, and it's a very nonpartisan issue. Like, it has nothing to do with politics, but a lot of different cities are actually mandated to develop where they don't really have the room and they don't want the development, right? Is that
exactly right? And the rub is, you know, the people in the communities and the local elected officials in the communities, they know what their communities need, right? They need their needs. And the rub really is, as you said, it's not partisan. It's whether the community should have local control, local decision-making authority over what's best for their community, even with regard to housing, or whether the state should dictate it from on high. And so a lot of cities, both progressive cities and conservative cities, are pushing back on state mandates and saying, wait, 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 this is way too much. This is an overreach. The state really, the purview is not to engage in local zoning and make local planning and land use decisions, but to engage in other things, right? Education, waste management, health, other issues are clearly the matter of state purview. But when it comes to local land use decisions, those have always been local decision making, right? By local city councils. And so what we're seeing is a pouring of support from other cities throughout the state saying, hey, keep up the good fight. Let us know if there's anything that we can do to join your lawsuit. Just notably, too, as part of the lawsuit, we're also alleging a couple of other things, if you don't mind me explaining. One is that with the state basically telling local city councils how they have to vote.
Yeah, you guys, the top of the hour is coming any minute. So I'll continue this video after that. See, these issues are really national. No, they're not just about California. This is Noreen Helfand, Wild at Heart Roundtable Show. We'll be back right after the break. Stay tuned.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us.
You don't need to expect us.
We're already here.
We're already here.
Thank you.
convinced that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
You're listening to the Wild at Heart Roundtable with Noreen Helpan, only at Revolution Radio.
Welcome back to Noreen Helpan's Wild at Heart Roundtable Show. You know, another thing, Gear Jammer in chat brought up something that made me think about the disposable style housing. Yeah, here's another problem, you guys, is, you know, as they aim to relocate people in and around 15-minute cities, whether they be like in a beach town like this or anywhere, right? The quality of housing, quality of life goes down, right? And really, your safety and your future, it's so hard to think, already gone, yes, thank you, the Eagles. It's so hard to think of humans operating the way they want us to do, what their goal is, right? Is for us to be like little kids. Oh, the government told us we're living here now. Oh, yeah, it doesn't look like grandma's house, but it's a house, it's an apartment. Yeah, cars, wow, that's something people used to drive. Yeah, we don't need that anymore because we live pretty much like, you know, in a kind of common place where you can just go, just walk within 50 minutes or take some kind of tram or anything, bike, and you're there, you know, and you don't really have to leave your area, you know, and you've got your virtual reality, so you can travel hundreds of miles somewhere in that, wearing that. That's the kind of world they want for us, you guys. This is all connected. It's so bizarre. It's so crazy and bizarre. Here we go. I'll play a little bit more of this. It's so fascinating.
They're basically taking duly elected officials who were vested at the local city council level with the discretion to make decisions over the for the communities, right? They're vested with that authority by the voters. Well, the state's basically coming in with these housing mandates and saying, hey, local city councils, you can't exercise the discretion that the voters vested you with. You have to make the decisions we tell you to make in order to advance our housing agenda. So there's some constitutional concerns there and constitutional challenges that we've mounted against the state of California, alleging First Amendment violations and so on and so forth. So there really are a lot of components to this fight. The other thing, too, is in 2022, the California State Auditor, which is a California agency, independent but California agency, found that the state's housing program, the RENA program,
the mandates, right.
And when I talk about these high-density housing mandates, a lot of folks understand it as the Regional Housing Needs Allocation. And the acronym for that is RHNA,
which
that's
is
RENA.
The state really mandating, saying you guys have to develop this many homes.
Exactly,
it's
a quota,
steady, right?
It's a quota, right? Well, the state auditor in 2022 found that HCD, which is the state's Housing and Community Development Department, found that they were wrong in their formulas for deriving those quotas, and they were wrong in their methodology and application to the cities. So not only is it fundamentally, constitutionally infirm for the state to come in and tell our...
See, that's another eradication of the bylaws of the Constitution, right? To mandate something from a state level in this manner is not constitutional. This is why this is complete communism. It's so bad, you guys, so bad.
Local city councils, how they have to vote. But the mandates themselves, the quotas themselves, are flawed. And the state auditor found that. It's not even the city of Huntington Beach coming to that conclusion. It's the state coming to that conclusion that the state didn't follow its own housing law when it came to these quotas. So there's a whole host of issues that we've presented in our lawsuit to challenge the state. I think the lawsuit is actually very, very compelling. I've heard from a lot of legal experts, frankly, that our case is remarkable. They think we've heard it's a winner from some other legal experts. So I'm really excited about the case. Right now, like I said, it's venued in federal court. There's a whole host of challenges that lie ahead in federal court. I have no idea of when it will finally be resolved. It could be months. It could be a couple years. We'll see. But our local city council, our mayor, Tony Strickland, and the city council is fully behind me in fighting this. They're fully invested in this fight because, as I said, it's a matter of local control. And if the city of Huntington Beach doesn't stand up and fight this now, and we were to roll over, Huntington Beach would be redeveloped, and we would lose all of our local control.
You're very passionate about this. It's your home, right? This is. I feel a passion in you. It's kind of like you care about this city because it's your home.
See, this hit a nerve here, right? You know how I feel about the situation in California. And whether you're in California or anywhere in the United States, whatever your local, municipalities, whatever they're doing, you should be concerned, See, this is what I'm trying to say. It's not about, it's not my city, so I don't care. We're not at that point anymore. We are literally at the point where every city and state matters in this country. Saving everything is critical, okay?
And tell me what it would look like in your mind if this development goes through.
Yeah, so on the one hand, I am passionate. It is my hometown. I grew up in Huntington Beach my whole life, which is why I ran for city attorney in 2014. I'm an elected city attorney, and it's a point of pride for me to represent my city. My city that I grew up in is now my client, and so it is really a labor of love. Huntington Beach would look like Santa Monica. I mean, we would have these pack and stacks, high-density development everywhere. And a lot of people say, this is about affordable housing, increasing the availability of affordable housing. But if you look at the RENA number itself, the state quotas, not all of that's even affordable housing. Really what it is it's high density. The state really has...
Yeah, you guys, we have to remember, whenever you overbuild, it could be for high-end living spaces or, on the other hand, low rent, like subsidized HUD and all that housing, right? But it doesn't do any good for the city. These are all bad, bad resolutions, okay?
As a high-density program.
So meaning program. Like really highly populated... because essentially your city will change, right? Is that
right?
It would go from God. Huntington Beach used to be a sleepy surf town, surf city, right? And it still has that suburban vibe, but it would just turn into another urban city. We don't really want this. You know, I live next to Long Beach, and I love Long Beach. Long Beach managed to kind of balance the urban, suburban, and the beach together, but they got their issues, don't get me wrong. They got a lot of great architecture, nightlife, restaurants, but, okay, but my point is, you know, like you talked about Santa Monica being like, yeah, Santa Monica is cool. It's cool, but it's overbuilt. And anywhere in this country that's overbuilt is not a good idea, okay?
It would look, if left unchecked, and if we abided by everything the state wanted us to do, eventually, over the next couple decades, we would look, it would be indistinguishable from a place like Santa Monica, where you have a lot of high-density buildings, a lot of high-density structures, which is basically apartment living rather than single-family home ownership. It's more like apartment living. And so it would be completely different. It really would change the culture of the city because, you know, you have a lot more transient living. You have people moving in for a year and then moving out. You have people moving in for a couple of years and then moving out.
Very important, you guys. People moving in, moving out. It's not just these beach cities, okay? This is what I was just saying in the beginning, okay? That this transiency trend, this is, I think that guy just inadvertently made me consolidate what I'm trying to say. You know, because like I said, I don't take it out personally on people to have to move. But when you have this transient mentality, well, it's because I have to, I get it. But this condition creates a transient mentality, which what? Leads to transient living for, and it does lead to people not even be able to build families, which is their goal. We know that. So it's all connected.
That's a different type of resident than somebody who, like in Huntington Beach, we have a lot of people who own their homes and who have owned their homes for 30, 40 years, or they're in the home that their parents lived in, right? And so for 30, 40 years before that. So we currently have a quiet suburban beach town community, a lot of home ownership. We're quiet, we tend to be conservative. We love our beach. We have 8 miles of pristine, beautiful coastline. Huntington Beach residents love Huntington Beach the way it is. And the last thing Huntington Beach residents want is for it to be converted into a place like Santa Monica, simply because the governor wants it to, or the state legislature wants it to. And the other reason I'm passionate, frankly, is I'm a lawyer. I love my profession in large part because I love the rule of law. I believe in the rule of law. And what the state is doing is unlawful, frankly. It violates the U.S. Constitution, and it also violates the California Constitution. And so the passion that I bring to the table about this fight with the state of California, yes, it's my hometown, and yes, I love Huntington Beach, but I also love the rule of law, and I know that what the state is doing is unlawful, and we're going to prove it in court. And so it's that type of passion and that energy that I bring to the table, that I bring to the case, but it comes from a good place of wanting to honor, as I said, the rule of law.
Now, some people argue that affordability is you know, it's very hard for people to rent homes here or buy homes here, and if we need this, and this is the state argument, you know, we need these homes to actually lower the cost of housing. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, when in any other industry, when a company or an organization is looking to see how do we lower prices or costs, right? They look at supply and demand, and their demand is known, right? But the state doesn't even know what the demand is with people leaving California, people coming into California. Past couple years, we've lost 700,000 residents, right? Huntington Beach has actually gone down in population over the past couple of years. And so the argument that the state is making that, well, there's an increase in demand, so we have to simply increase the supply of housing, that's a false premise in the first place. And we're going to prove that in court, that the increase in demand really isn't the reason for the increase in cost, right? A lot of property throughout the state of California is expensive, but simply increasing the supply does not address the problem of affordability. If the state was serious about supply and demand and serious about providing more supply in order to lower the price, they would target the undeveloped areas of the state and come up with an incentive program rather than a punishment program, but an incentive program to actually bring developers and cities who want to develop in their undeveloped areas together to develop more housing. And that's where they could put the increased supply, and then they could see if the increased supply would satisfy the demand in order to lower costs. But I will tell you this, there is zero data out there right now, zero, none, that supports the notion that increased high density development lowers costs of living. There's nothing, it's not out there. This is all theoretical, and I think the governor and the legislature is hoping that some of the basic economics 101 principles of supply and demand, that the community will buy into that and assume and buy into the fact that, well, if we increase supply, then costs will go down. When it comes to housing, when it comes to housing in California, when it comes to what the state is trying to do, it's categorically false. It doesn't work.
Now, we just covered this in our documentary, People Leaving California, The Untold Story, and we actually went into, there was a section on housing, mm-hmm. and one of the main questions I had is just like, why are we not developing all the land that we have? You know, how is it that, and then we dove into the all the regulations that exist and how difficult it is and all the lawsuits, and it looks like we're paying for lawyers as a part of our housing costs, you know,
when Yes, you're right.
And no offense, you're a lawyer, but
No, I get it. And really, another aspect to the point that you're making is the state, California, through all of its environmental regulations over the years, and even more so more recently, they've added to the red tape. They've added to the cost of development in the first place. So to your point, another thing that needs to be looked at is, what is the state doing and what has it been doing through its environmental regulations, its bureaucracy, and all the red tape? Believe it or not, there's data out there to show that just over the past couple years or few years, they've increased the cost of developing housing per unit on average by over $100,000. So if there's any empirical data that we actually can point to the cause of the rising cost of housing, it's actually the state and its environmental regulations and all of the red tape and all the bureaucracy that has added to over $100,000 per unit of development. That's incredible. So to your point, there are other things that we could be looking at and should be looking
at. So one of the things that came up in the during the process of making this documentary, we were actually interviewing an expert, and she told us she just built a new home, and she realized it's mandated for her to have solar. Mm-hmm. Now, all the new homes in California need to have solar. That adds like $30,000 to $40,000.
See, this is how they do this, right? They tack on all these things, make them mandates, codes, whatever, that have to be enforced. And, you know, a lot of companies and even bigger picture, BlackRock, Vanguard, George Soros, you know, entities, they are in with this too. So it's just creating like an atmosphere where the average person who wants to have a home is confronted with all this, and then the cities get confronted with it too. It's just a whole big racket.
Per unit, yeah, you know, to each house, right, of cost if you have to put solar on.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of regulations like this that has come into the play.
And all the inspections, all the permitting, all the fees. A lot of that stuff is California environmental law generated. And so, you know, the state has basically created a problem that they're attempting to resolve, but they're not really. They're just creating another new problem for cities like Huntington Beach.
Which, you guys, do you have the infrastructure to handle the population growth if you had it?
Well, that's a question for experts, but just as a resident and one who's been close to these housing issues in Huntington Beach now for a number of years, I can tell you, I think categorically the answer is no. There's no way. All of our drainage systems, all of our water systems, all of our electrical systems, all of our public safety systems have been designed for a city of 81,000 dwelling units, which is what we have, 81,000 dwellings, with a population of approximately 200,000 people. That's what the infrastructure is built for. So to suddenly dramatically, possibly double that over the next 10 to 20 years, the infrastructure is not there for that. And so what's the state going to do when our infrastructure breaks or our cost of governing through trying to fund public safety sufficient to handle maybe an actual population of 400,000 people or more? What's the state going to do then? Nothing. It's going to sit idly by and watch the city of Huntington Beach suffer, both through broken and worn and torn infrastructure, but also funding all of these things to keep up. Like our police department will have to double in size, right? Our fire department, double in size. We're a full service city. Public works department, double in size. So all of these things are burdens that the state's program is placing on already developed cities that they would not be imposing or burdening if they just focused on undeveloped areas. They could start the infrastructure new.
Here's the problem that I have with put undeveloped areas in a sense. Realize that when you're talking about this 50-minute city plan, right, the migrant equation comes into the picture. Since the last few years, we've had this unbridled immigration coming in from south of the border, from different countries in this world. Those are the people that they're going to try to stuff into these 50-minute cities, you guys. I mean, or other kinds of dwellings, okay? I'm just saying, all kinds of dwellings. So this is part of a plan for the takedown of the United States as we know it. So it's all interconnected.
There, right? So there's a major disparity between the effects of the state's agenda and the state's policy, depending on whether they're focused on already developed cities like they are in Huntington Beach, or if they would shift to undeveloped areas of the state.
Now, you got into this legal battle with the state. You sued them first, right? Or they sued you first?
So there's a couple different lawsuits going on. We sued them with sort of what I consider the kind of the mothership of all housing lawsuits that we filed in federal court. And then the state did sue us on a couple other issues with regard to ADUs and SB9, which has since become not an issue, and that case should go away. But the state has come out with a lot of press releases and even a couple press conferences taking to the bully pulpit and sort of singling out Huntington Beach and shaming Huntington Beach for not stepping up and doing its fair share. And what our response is, you know, it's pretty laughable because the state, Governor Newsom, is trying to point the finger at us and say that somehow Huntington Beach isn't stepping up yet. Believe it or not, his own hometown, his own county of Marin County, is allowed to skirt all of these housing mandates. So while he...
Yeah, while him and Pelosi and all these rich people all across the country of similar political aim and ilk, you know, not for me, not for my royal ass family, but you guys could suffer. F you.
He's at the bully pulpit poking the finger at Huntington Beach. His hometown does not have to honor the same housing mandates. Marin County does not have to honor it. So he's accepted or exempted Marin County, his hometown, from these mandates. So the whole thing is...
So there is favors in this process. Some cities are... Right. The cities that have better relationships, better connections, are getting less mandates from that same housing.
Exactly. And you can look at the city of Napa, same thing. City of Commerce, same thing. They're getting special treatment, whereas places like Huntington Beach, we think that we've been dealt an excessive burden by HCD and the state laws. And frankly, it does feel pretty punitive. And Huntington Beach has a history with Sacramento, right? When COVID hit and there was the lockdowns, Gavin Newsom sent armed state troopers down to Huntington Beach and some other beach cities in Orange County to shut down our beaches. So,
yeah, Gavin Newsom has a personal vendetta against Huntington Beach because, like you said earlier, Huntington Beach is, you know, typical suburban seaside town on the conservative side, doesn't want the big hand of government dictating what to do. So, yeah, that's what's going on.
So they literally put up concrete barricades. They took bulldozers and pushed mountains of sand over the bike paths and the walking paths and like literally shut down the beaches with state troopers. And we sued the state of California. And we basically alleged in our lawsuit that the state doesn't have the authority to close our local beaches, that those are under our local purview. And within a couple days of us filing the lawsuit, suddenly Gavin Newsom opened up the beaches again, and we were able to get our beaches back. But think of all of the beaches up and down the state of California. Only the ones in Orange County were closed by Governor Newsom. So there's a strange relationship that we have with Sacramento, with Governor Newsom. It is pretty strained, perhaps unfortunately. But Huntington Beach has never really looked for a fight. Huntington Beach and its city council has just always simply tried to make the best decisions for Huntington Beach. And somehow Sacramento has taken exception to that.
Now, Michael, is there a way for you guys, you know, this is, you know, for me, it's kind of like when I listen to this and I think about it more, it's like, how did we get here? Why is the city suing the state? The state suing the city. How can we go back to sitting at the table and having a conversation? Right. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a great question. I think if perhaps 10 years ago or whenever plans in Sacramento were being drawn up to increase housing, the state would have sat down with cities and said, hey, how can we move forward together? I think that would have been the time to do it. Rather than that, they came out in 2017, 2018, and in the years thereafter with a flurry of very aggressive housing laws, most of which are mandates on cities to implement the high-density housing quotas and so on and so forth, and also to actually take discretionary control and approval away from councils and allow developers to go in and make decisions on their own, sidestepping some of the local zoning requirements. So there's just a lot happening at the state level that's very obtrusive. I mean, it's very intrusive. It really seeks to take away, essentially, like I said, local control. And so Huntington Beach's interest has always been in trying to mind its own business, trying to govern for itself. But when there's overreach and there's interference from the state over matters of local control, we have no choice but to push back. So necessarily causes conflict in court.
Now, this is a pretty big undertaking. You know, I know a lot of the cities are watching. I know city leaders are watching you guys. What about you? Are you concerned of going to court with, like, kind of sticking your neck out there?
No, not at all, really. I don't know if it's just in my DNA or it's just a passion, but I love stepping up for the challenge. I've tried cases against some of the best attorneys in the state of California and beat them. We have a couple cases right now. I'm going to trial myself in a few weeks in one of our police shooting cases against the number one plaintiff's attorney in the state of California on police shooting cases. So I love being in court. I love fighting the good fight. For me, there's a good cause at issue. There's a good cause at hand. And I love fighting for that cause. So, and as I said, I love the rule of law. So for me, it isn't about me per se. I just don't mind being the one going in and fighting for the law, fighting for what's right. So Governor Newsom and Attorney General Bonta can take to the podium every day of the week if they want and point the finger at Huntington Beach and try to poke at us. I can tell you that we are not intimidated. We are not deterred. We are fully ready, able, and equipped to go into court and make our best case.
Now, is there a way for you guys to resolve this? And me being naive here, is there a way for us to resolve this with you guys sitting at a table, have a meeting with them? Is it possible to get there?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure how, because the state train on high density has sort of left the station, right? And so I don't know, other than them walking back or modifying state law, I don't know what can be done at this point. The city, you know, time is of the essence, right? If the city were to sit on its hands, then developers would try to come in and start developing high density with or without the city's attempt to say so or try to control the process, right? So our best shot to try to maintain the status quo and not allow harm to be done to the city by the state's mandates or the state laws is to run into court and try to have it dealt with at a judicial level. So we're doing everything that we can to try to help defend and protect Huntington Beach.
Now, do you have any other thoughts for our audience?
Well, I just want the audience to know that it's important for local communities to stand up for what's best for their community. Don't simply accept state mandates and roll over that because there's a larger, more powerful government in California that simply you have to relinquish all control. No, the California Constitution literally provides for local control. Communities need to tap into that. What I would ask residents to do if they think to themselves, what can I do, is go and talk to their local city council members, their local mayors, and ask those governments to stand up to the state, whether it's pass local resolutions opposing the state's housing mandates, or maybe possibly look at joining our lawsuit or filing their own lawsuits. But we absolutely need cities to stand up and speak up and push back on what's going on and coming down from the state of California.
Michael Gates, City Attorney of Huntington Beach, it was great to have you on California Insider.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This is a very good series, this California Insider. It's very good, actually. I do like it. Yeah, you know, you guys, I took CDS, and that actually helped me with my cold yesterday. I know it sounds bad, but it is actually on the mend. It's just breaking up. That's why it sounds kind of horsey. Ivermectin, I think I still have it. That stuff dries up in the tube, though, so I better look for it and use it quickly. Otherwise, I'll have to reorder some. But thanks for the reminder on that. You know, you guys, you can overdo ivermectin, okay? I'm just saying. But in my case, if I take it for this cold, it's not going to be that long. And I already took CDS. That should be good enough along with my other over-the-counter things. But I might take ivermectin. I have a little bit somewhere. I have to look for it. Anyways. So we have about half an hour left of this show. I'm thinking, since again my voice is kind of raspy, hard to talk a little bit, I might play a little bit of Chris Williams, and you know he has a good series. And he's got Douglas Murray as a guest on this show. Interviews. So I'll play a little bit of that.
Events at the moment. How would you rate your predictive ability given the current state of the world? Were there things that you foresaw coming or things that you've been particularly surprised by?
Well, nobody gets to predict with 100% accuracy anything, because among other things, all the time things happen that you could never have seen coming. I could never have seen COVID coming. I just didn't. So whenever anyone sort of boasts about their predictive capabilities, I always think you have to do it with a certain amount of humility, because, I mean, things happen all the time you couldn't see. You can only see round the bend of the road you're coming to. You can't see round the corner. I mean, some things I've written about for years, particularly in my book, The Strange Death of Europe, that came out in 2017, which I think are sadly coming to fruition. I say sadly because people think that if you predicted something and got it right, you would feel any pleasure. And that would only be if the thing you were predicting was something you looked forward to. And what I was predicting was something I was dreading. And that was the transformation of our country of birth and many other countries in the West due to demographic change. And I mean, every day now, pretty much, somebody says to me, gosh, I used to think what you were saying in The Strange Death of Europe was a bit out there, and now I realize you were right. But it gives me no pleasure for them to say that. Because I always sort of think, well, if you'd have agreed back then, some things might not have happened. But you know, as Mark Stein said, you know, demographics is destiny. So it's one of the things you can predict with the most ease. Yeah.
Did you have Victoria's Secret's plan to bring sexy back on your 2023 bingo card?
Why are Victoria's Secret's bringing sexy back?
After experimenting with 300-pound mannequins, plus-size models, disabled models, trans models, a male model, and a 38-year-old football player, Victoria's Secrets have made the controversial decision to switch strategy and start using hot women to model their underwear again.
It makes commercial sense, to my mind. Yeah, it is quite easy. I'm always amazed that advertising executives find it complex, this stuff. I mean, all you need to do is stick sexy girls on stuff, and you can sell the merchandise. It pretty much writes itself. I'm not particularly surprised that if you stick Lizzo in a bikini, it's not as appealing as a bit of sales merchandise. But, you know, live and learn, I suppose.
Live and learn. One of my friends owns a very big clothing company, and for a while they tried plus-sized models.
Yeah.
Mostly for women. There's not much of a body positivity movement for men.
No, like a beer gut movement.
The skinny fat revolution. Yeah. He said, we've split tested this into oblivion. Big girls don't sell clothes.
Right.
So when you see that, when you see a company, you know, Ann Summers are making double plus-sized dildos or whatever, the company is actively hurting their top line and bottom line to be able to send the right message.
Right.
And that's all well and good up until some shareholder meeting where some 70-year-old guy looks at the far right column of an Excel sheet and goes, what the fuck's this?
Yes.
And they go, no, you don't understand. It's this really cool new movement. It's very progressive. And he goes, I don't care.
Right.
I want more money than we had last year, and this is less money than we had last year.
Yeah. Yeah, they, I suppose it all starts off from a good place, like some or many things. But look, if you might agree that, you know, it's not a good thing to sell anorexic looking models to young women. That's, yeah, okay, let's all agree on that. But you can stop somewhere before morbidly obese. You know, that's where the whole thing goes wrong with the body positivity thing. Plus, there's a place where body positivity shouldn't occur. It should be, I mean, if somebody is so morbidly obese that they're at significant risk of heart failure, you shouldn't celebrate them. You should say, hang on a minute, steady on the donuts. But they don't say that. They just did. They run all the way. I wish you could just have sort of healthy looking women on the ads and just draw the line there. But as ever, they sort of don't know where the line is. Until, as you say, something wrenches them back. And the thing that wrenches them back is normally, as you say, the bottom line.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this sort of performative empathy point for a while. Got this idea, I need to meme it better. But I think something like short-term empathy or the shallow pond of empathy, I've been thinking about what is most popular in culture at the moment is something that optimizes for its immediacy to signal that you are a good guy. Or good girl,
right?
Even if that's at the expense of the ultimate outcome for the person. So let's say you're able to do something, giving the child ice cream. It may be what it wants right now. It may be bad for it long term. But if you're the ice cream promoter for the young children, you will be seen as a good person. Mm-hmm. And if you're the person who's saying, hang on a second,
yeah,
that's not what you want long term. Maybe responsibility in Peterson language, maybe not casual sex in Louise Perry language, maybe, you know, not as much food as you want in body positivity language. You're seen as bigoted or judgmental or whatever.
That's because there's no countervailing force in the culture. The unlimited empathy people have run a long way very fast because, as you say, there's a short term gain to be seen to be being empathetic. You know, let's celebrate yourself. But ordinarily, you would have some other counterforce in the society, and different forces have provided that in history, including the church. But if there is no counterforce to say, for instance, you know, long-term gratification better than short-term, or you know, whatever, then that's a sort of unappealing position in our society now. There's plenty of room for people to be in that space, but you're still on the defensive. You know, we still live in a society where effectively to own an ice cream truck, you know, in the sort of language of a child, would seem to be a great thing. So let's have the short-term thing. Not many people want that role. It's sort of uncool in some way. It might become cool at some point in the future when more people realize that the short-term gratification thing was leading to diabetes or whatever. But
It's the same as one of the justifications, I think, for why people aren't having children, that upfront children, you just see a very, very large cost on all of the joy and and stuff.
Well, but, see, the Economist put it as the child tax, the amount of money you have less if you have a child. A weird way round to look at the future of the species, isn't it? If only I died with more money in my bank account. Life of regret.
Death of regret, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of the, as well, the Mexican fisherman story. Are you familiar with that? The parable of the Mexican fisherman?
No, I don't think I am.
This is cool. You'll like this. So an American businessman goes on holiday to Mexico. And while he's there...
Is it a true story?
It's a parable.
Okay. Got it.
Fucking hell. He goes on holiday. He gets taken out fishing by a local Mexican. And he asks the Mexican how he spends his time. The Mexican says, I fish a little in the morning. I catch enough for my family. We go back. We cook. We laugh around the fire. And I spend time with my children. And the American businessman goes, that's stupid. Here's a better idea. What you should do is actually spend most of your day fishing, and then with the surplus fish, you could sell them at the market. And the Mexican fisherman says, why would I do that? So, well, once you've got the additional money, you could start to employ some of your friends, and they could come out fishing with you too, and you could catch more fish, which you could sell at the market for more money. He says, why would I do that? He says, well, once you've done that, you would be able to incorporate in America, and you would maybe be able to start a canning factory so that you could own the entire production process. And you could then sell the company for a lot of money. I said, why would I do that? He said, because once you'd done that, you'd be able to fish a little on a morning and then go back and spend time with your children around the fire.
Very good.
And I often think about that as a much more direct route to happiness, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the classic thing, that the place you end up is the place you started from. But yes, there are lots of reasons why people aren't having children. And a lot of them are simple economic things. I mean, all of the Western countries that have terrible replacement birth rate figures are because of very easy things to solve, like cost of housing and things like that. And it's not hard to build affordable housing. We just proved to be incapable of doing so. So young people wanting to both get on the property ladder and start a family think they have to do either or. And they're not entirely wrong, but that's something that governments could have sorted out, and none of them do. They're so hopeless at it, and they have been for years under consecutive governments. They never build enough housing, so young people don't see a future, don't feel hopeless, and then don't have kids, and then everyone wonders why there's a demographic crisis.
Intergenerational competition theory is something I learned about a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. You familiar with this?
Yeah.
I didn't know about it before, but it makes complete sense. You know, there was always this talk of millennials are the first generation to have done worse than their parents. And it seems
they're not the first. First in a little while.
Yes.
First in two generations.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit long.
And it seems like millennials actually probably just about managed to get over on average. Okay. But Gen Z materially.
Yeah.
Difficulty in getting on the property ladder. The most common living arrangement for men under 35 is still at home with their parents.
Awful.
It bakes in this sort of intergenerational competitiveness and a dissatisfaction when you look at where your parents were, and this felt sense that your parents got advantages that you never did.
Which is usually not true. I mean, they didn't suffer inflation at the same rates, but they suffered very high taxation in the post-war period. We haven't had taxation at the levels it was at in the 1960s and 70s, for instance, in the UK. There was a time when people were top rate taxpayers were paying 99% tax. A friend who once in that period paid over 100% tax one year for reasons he could.
How's that possible?
It'll be back tax and that sort of thing. So, I mean, there's a tendency, particularly among millennials and after, to think that their parents had it very easy. My experience of people from that generation, the boomer generation, it didn't feel easy at the time. And yeah, there were certain things. Getting on the property housing ladder was a little bit easier than it is, or significantly easier, once you have, what is it, 5 times average earnings, being the inadequate to get to the average property price. You see a split go on, but you always have to factor. I mean, like if you say the millennials are the first ones, or Gen Z were the first ones since whoever to have a better standard of living, you have to bake in things like, oh yeah, well they had a world war, So that's quite a big PS. Well, that's a big footnote. Everyone has their challenges. I just don't see why once you've identified them and know the way out of them, you don't do them. But
I was talking to mutual friend Eric Weinstein about this. I also spoke to Sam about this. I've spoken to a bunch of people. Why, in your opinion, do you think everybody struggles to agree on the truth now?
Oh, that's quite straightforward. We can't agree on what's happened. So, broadly speaking, an event happens now, and some people believe it has happened, and other people think it hasn't. We've been through a number of deranging years since we first spoke, in which, for instance, you know, they say there's been a global pandemic, which some people believe was something which killed millions and millions of people in their own country and think they were just about saved from dying themselves. And other people think it was a fake. And other people think we just massively overreacted. And other people think it was all planned. And nobody agrees what happened. That's just to take one example. In America, you have obviously the fact that nobody agrees who won an election. That's a problem. And so you just have basic things nobody can agree on. It just happened. I always say in America, you know, it'd be nice if we could just agree that one thing that's just happened. But then nobody wants to. It says you must be a WEF shill if you believe that. So I think it is the problem. And obviously underneath that is just the problem, the fact that the treadmill of social media has totally changed the way in which we communicate, the way in which we learn things, absorb things. And we don't know what the consequences of that are. We're so early into it. And it seems to me that, among other things, it's allowed people to have their own version of recent events, recent history, past few days. And so when you sit down to talk to somebody, you can fairly swiftly work out whether they're somebody who's open to the idea of things that happened having happened, or whether or not they will fight you all the way. And that just makes everything much harder than it used to be. And that isn't to sort of particularly pine for the era of a mononarrative, if that era ever particularly existed. And you read history, not clear that it did. But it's just massively worse. And news is coming at us at such a pace these days that it's just like, you know, every day feels like, you know, a month's worth of news in the past. Things just fly by you so fast that you don't even have time to absorb it before it's happened. So I think that's part of the reason. And in any case, the whole concept of truth as being a desirable thing in the society seems to have eroded from both the right and the left. And
how so?
Truth, for instance, used to be the basis for a university education and the basis of university inquiry, that you sought the truth wherever it led you. That was the point of academia, for instance. Politics was different. Politics was always about having to find a way around truth and deal with it and address
it. Pesky inconvenience.
Yeah, address it where you could, but, you know, get around it if it was too awkward. But inquiry used to be about seeking truth. And we've been like that for a couple of thousand years or more, since the Greeks, certainly. And then it changed at some point relatively recently. And truth is now not a desirable thing because truth hurts people. And it can be mean.
So it's not only that people have different opinions on things.
They don't agree that the thing we used to agree on is worth.
They have different facts as well.
Well, they have different facts, but they don't agree that they don't agree that you should just follow truth wherever it takes you. Because other things are prioritized over truth. I still prioritize truth over all things if I can and try to. And I think that's the interesting thing about the world, is finding out what in it is true and what is not. But other people don't seem to have that same appetite anymore, and would rather live in lies, which I think is very dangerous for an individual and very dangerous for society. In fact,
living in lies, you guys. This is the enablers of our society to do this. You know, they just accept the lie and think things will be okay if you just go along with the lie. Well, that it doesn't work that way.
It's dangerous for an individual and lethal in a society, I'd say.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about the motivations that people have for not believing something which is already on an unshaky foundation of we can't agree on the thing that we're not believing about. Mm-hmm. And Gwinda, one of my friends, has this idea that if no amount of evidence would dissuade someone of what they believe, then they don't have a rational belief. They have a religious ideology.
Yeah. That's Jonathan Swift. He put it as you can't reason somebody out of a position they weren't reasoned into. Yeah. Of course. I mean, you're dealing with dogma with many people today. It's just they don't know which faith they belong to. But it's dogma for sure. I just am not very interested in their views because I think they can't defend them. And if you can't defend your views, I'm not very interested in them because I don't find them persuasive.
I asked Sam this about whether or not, you see, 10, 15 years ago, he was a big part of the new atheist movement. And I guess you were tangentially on the...
I was a little bit of a whippersnapper. I was a short trousers. New atheist.
Okay. But, you know, your book, The Madness of Crowds, talks about the collapse of grand narratives. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest collapses of grand narratives was religion. Mm-hmm. So I asked Sam whether or not, looking back, he believed that his deconstruction of religion was on balance a net good or a net net negative.
What did he say?
He managed to evade being too committal either way, I think. But what do you think? What's your opinion?
Well, I think it's like a lot of things that you deconstruct. You only know afterwards whether or not it's something you've put back together. It's like children with bicycles. They're very fine at taking them apart, very bad at putting them back together. Not Sandra Child. But I mean, I think that is, it is something you notice only once you've taken it apart, once you can't reconstruct it. You'd realize what function it might have performed. I said to Sam on stage a few years ago that I thought that it would all be fine if most atheists were as rational and level-headed as Sam, but it's not Sam Harris all the way down. It's like Sam Harris followed by total mentalists and who just will not reason or rationalize anything and are just screaming harpies of insanity. So that's a shame. But yes, I mean, the whole thing works for some people, but obviously doesn't work for others. I mean, religion is, you know, Schopenhauer, among others, saw it was philosophy of masses. Absent religion completely, several lots of options of what will happen. One is that the general public lose the overarching framework of their lives and have nothing to replace it with. And another one is that they do replace it with other things, you know, to new religions which crop up all the time. We have the religion of the body negativity movement. You know, we have the religion of trans. We have the religion of gender. We have the religion of race. And, you know, and all these things have just stepped into this void. And they're all dogmatic things with their founding texts. They've got their own catechisms of a kind.
Priests.
They're priests. They have excommunication rites. And my only observation really would be on that is that I preferred the old gods. You know, I preferred the old priesthood, funnily enough, partly because we knew its flaws. And the sweet point where you see the flaws of religious belief but can still live through it is what...
Hey, you guys, I like Douglas Murray. However, in this interview, granted, I mean, I've heard him being interviewed by other Brits before. For some reason, this is a very casual kind of form of interview that Chris Williamson's doing with him. And it's fine, but it is a little bit, would you say that it's a little bit difficult to comprehend some things with this kind of British style of speaking, right? I am a little challenged with that because it's not what we grew up with here in the U.S., but nevertheless, doesn't mean it's not good. It's just a different way of talking, using vocabulary, and so forth. Style of speaking, British, is a little, obviously a little bit different, and so forth.
Well, one even I can, well, I can especially feel nostalgic for because yeah. I don't like the new priesthood. I find them as corrupt as any priesthood in history. with the negative attribute that not everyone's woken up to them yet. You know, I mean, do we have in our culture an equivalent, for instance, of the meme of the paedophile priest? I don't think we do. I mean, for instance, I would love it if the sort of adults who push, you know, gender dysmorphia stuff on children were regarded as the equivalent of paedophile priests. I think that'd be fine. But my point is, it doesn't come with that yet. It's like the Catholic Church in Boston circa 1950. The priests are still fiddling with the kids, but no one wants to talk about it. So.
In other news, this episode is brought to you by Maui Nui Venison.
Well, what do you optimize for?
I try to optimize for peace. That seems to be the thing that, for me, in my personal life, I try to do. If the price is my sanity, the cost is too high, no matter what it is. And I continually throw that rule out of the window all the time. That's what I try and aim for, right? My own rubric is...
I love that, the peace in your private life.
I try.
It reminds me of Lady Bracknell's line about the general at the end of The Importance of Being Earnest. She says, the general was essentially a man of peace, except in his domestic life. You're the other way around.
Yeah,
you're a man of peace in your domestic life,
except for my
maybe
public
you are
life.
Generally as
no
well.
I don't think I am.
You're a highly agreeable person.
I'm fucking not,
really.
I try as best I can to keep a lid on it, but yeah, the
well, I was looking at the timestamps for this interview, which I think I might play some of this next Monday. It's actually interesting. They're going to go into the K-pop phenomena, which, you know, that creates body dysmorphia too, right? The K-pop entertainers, the young Koreans, you know, they're like, they got every kind of conceivable plastic surgery, pressure to be thin. And so that's affecting the rest of the pop culture and younger people that follow it as well, whether even outside of Korea. So that's very interesting. So,
this lack of meaning and people's desire, their absolutely fervent desire to try and fill that hole with as many things as they can.
Like Lizzo.
Like Lizzo, indeed. Did you?
Oh, Lizzo. Oh, God.
Did you see the stories that came out about Lizzo?
Oh, it was wonderful.
About her Amsterdam.
My favorite story of the year.
Yeah.
Well, a long way.
What, for the people that don't know, Lizzo was on tour in Amsterdam, took her backup dancers to the red light district,
yes,
and made the backup dancers, some of the backup dancers, eat bananas out of the vaginas of Amsterdam strippers.
My view is what had happened here.
I didn't hear that detail about Lizzo. I know they sued her for sexual harassment, which is reasonable. That is a very strange story, though, huh? I have to follow up on that one. So I think the music is going to come in any time now. So thanks for listening. I think that's it. This is Noreen Halpin, Wild at Heart Roundtable Show. See you guys next week. Take care.
Natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crip Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Alert, alert, listen.
0917 We talk about decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal.